This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
And Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news. To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, welcome in to another episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast. Got a great show lined up for you today. Two guests coming up with two of the most interesting teams, really, in basketball that we're going to take a deep dive into. First up is Jonathan Fagan, covers the Rockets for the Houston Chronicle. Been a very interesting offseason for the Houston Rockets. They lose Trevor Ariza, Luka Bamute, but they add Carmelo Anthony. Are they a better team? How are they going to play? Get into all that and more with Jonathan Fagan. A little bit later on, I check in with Michael Grange from Sportsnet out in Toronto. Another team that had a big shakeup this offseason. Kawhi Leonard is in. DeMar DeRozan is out. Nick Nurse is the head coach. How does that all work? I get into all that and more with Michael Grange over at Sportsnet in Toronto. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcast, also known as iTunes. Post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast, as promised, Jonathan Fagan, the Rockets beat writer over at the Houston Chronicle. What's happening, John?
Not much. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Let's jump right into it here with the Rockets. Interesting offseason, to say the least, with Houston. Let me start with you with what kind of could have been. You know, 65-win team, win away from the finals, perhaps a win away from a championship. Did you get the sense at the end of the season that the Rockets' priority, or that it was a priority for them, to keep that entire team together and bring it back whole?
Yes, maybe not with the word entire. For the most part, that was the goal. Run it back was kind of what they kept saying, that that was the intention. I think the reason I won't kind of embrace the word entire, I think they thought all along they would be losing Trevor Ariza. In fact, I know they did. But they never thought there was a good chance. Now, they were surprised it went for a one-year deal, even at $15 million, and for a team with the worst record in the league. You know, he went from a team with the best record to the team with the worst. That they would not have predicted. But I don't think they were optimistic in any way that they would be keeping Ariza. I think that they thought they'd be able to keep Luke Bamute and therefore run it back. Chris Paul, Gerald Green, and so on.
Okay, with Ariza, though, I mean, why do you think they were convinced they were going to lose him? I mean, the one-year deal, I think, caught a lot of people off guard. As you said, the Suns being the destination, that was a surprise, too.
Well, I think they thought, as many of us did, that he was at a stage of his career where he would have to take the last best contract that he could, that it was that time. You know, for them to compete with that, for a guy who's kind of their fifth most important player, maybe fourth, maybe even sixth, I'd say probably fifth most important player, and given their tax situation, as is, the contract he got would have cost them nearly $60 million. Given what tax situation they're in and what it would have put them to, they kind of thought it would work out that way. It doesn't make as much sense for them.
You know, it did surprise me, John, just because of, you know better than I do, the value of Trevor Ariza. I know he didn't play well in that game 7 against the Warriors, but, you know, up and down, you know, whether it's locker room, defense, you know, versatility, he just brings a lot to the table. Did their belief that they couldn't bring him back, that money was such a factor, did that surprise you at all?
No. In some ways, and I don't mean this to disparage Trevor, and I'll explain in a second that that would be wrong to do, but it is a little bit like the old Grant Ricky thing. It's better to lose a guy a year too soon than a year too late. So there was some of that they were – they're okay without a guy who I would consider their fifth most important guy. Now you could say, hey, fifth most important guy on a team with championship aspirations is pretty darn important. And I would agree in this case. Trevor, he's such a perfect fit for the Stars. I think that was the great value that people talk about a lot. That's exactly what you want. A 3-and-D guy who embraces his role and is a true pro, which he really is. It's not just reputation. He really is a pro and a role model type of guy. That's part of what Phoenix is paying for. That's all true and makes perfect sense as a great fit. He's not the defensive player that he was a couple years ago when he was underrated defensively. He didn't get his due for just how good he was on the ball. I mean, people forget or didn't notice that when the Rockets had Pat Beverly, one of the best defensive guards in the league, they were putting Trevor Ariza on Russell Westbrook and on Steph Curry. You wouldn't do that now. They didn't do that last year. Luke Bamute was better on the ball than Trevor was. Trevor made up for that because he was a playmaker defensively. He was so smart and engaged that if he could see something breaking down, he would know where to be and get a deflection or get a steal, and he would do it all without making mistakes. And his versatility to switch so much was of great value to them. But he was not all that he was physically a couple of years before. You could see as a team evolves how it would transition that way. It's kind of like the Rockets were a championship caliber team, but they didn't win a championship. Championship teams kind of accept, hey, that's what happens. You can't keep everybody at the prices they're going to get because we just won a championship. They kind of thought that would happen with Trevor. They just didn't think, like as we said before, 1 year to Phoenix, that they would never have predicted. I wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. But they did think, yeah, that could be the one that they would be most trouble with.
Okay, so they lose a reason. That deal was a pretty big deal, even for just 1 year. But Bamute's deal with the Clippers, not that big. I mean, $4.5 million per year on that one. I know people can debate nationally the value of Mbamute to that team because of the injury at the end of the season. But I mean, what was the reasoning, do you think, behind Mbamute not getting the money needed to come back?
Well, here's the exact reasoning, and it is very much opens them up for debate. They viewed his shoulder as not ruined. They think the probability is he will come back and be okay. Remember, he did it twice last year, which is a little bit of a red flag when it happens a second time. So they thought, okay, no, he's okay. He'll be all right. But there is a chance. There's now that possibility that, no, it's going to be an ongoing problem. So they evaluated, all right, you know, we'll do it, but now he's more of a risk. We'll only go up this far. And they went up to about $2.9 million. That's where you're open to debate. Really, the difference of another $1.5 million, plus it had some taxes, and so sure, it would be a lot more than that. But still, that's the difference of a guy that important as he became after Trevor left. It opens him up for debate, but that was the thinking, that there's a possibility. It's not the probability, but there is some sort of percentage chance this could be an ongoing problem. Mm-hmm. And so that was very much a factor in where they drew the line and why they wouldn't move it.
So two fairly important guys go out in Houston. And of course the big name to replace them is Carmelo Anthony. Let me run my theory of the Rockets and Carmelo Anthony by you, John. Let me get your thoughts on it. Carmelo to me in Houston is almost like a nuclear option. Like they lose Ariza, they lose Mbamute. There's not a lot of valuable guys on the market they can sign for a low dollar figure. Carmelo's coming in at basically the veteran's minimum. It's a low risk, high reward type, a potential high reward type of acquisition for him. But it did smack a little bit of kind of desperation. Like here's the faded former star who's got a relationship with Chris Paul and with James Harden. Let's bring him in and see if we can somehow catch lightning in a bottle and make it work with Carmelo. What do you think?
Well, there's two things about that. Absolutely, of course, that's what he is. It's low risk, costs you almost nothing. And you can still get enough of Carmelo to be of value to you. You got to back up in that they already signed James Ennis, who is very important to what they plan. he defensively can be more Luke Faamute than Trevor Ariza, and that I wouldn't expect him to be the disruptor that Trevor was in terms of passing lanes and breaking down what an offense is trying to do, but better on the ball than Trevor, which is something Carmelo will absolutely not be on wings. You know, Trevor's not maybe the guy you put on points anymore. Faamute was. You could put him on anybody. They feel like on the ball, Ennis can be that. So that changes what is asked of Carmelo. If Ennis can hit a decent enough percentage of threes to take enough minutes, then the defense doesn't fall off so much that then Carmelo's offense becomes more of a weapon rather than, well, does it make up for his defense? That's when, okay, then he becomes what you're describing of he can be a real weapon. Because offensively, he's got enough of Carmelo left in him. He's going to be good offensively. I really don't think there's any doubt. It's how many minutes do you have to play him as a three? How many minutes do you have to play him at all? And then what do you have to do defensively to make that work with a guy who's not as good defensively as the two who left?
What's your understanding? You know, I know what Mike D'Antoni's saying publicly, but, you know, look, I lived in New York when Mike was there with Carmelo. I knew a lot of people in that organization, and I know that, you know, and I've said this before, but Carmelo Anthony wasn't a reason that Mike D'Antoni left New York. He was arguably, maybe not even arguably, the reason that Mike D'Antoni left New York. I mean, what's your understanding of where D'Antoni is with all this?
Well, he's on board and was last summer as well. Remember last summer when Carmelo wanted to come here? The Rockets' interest in him was very much with D'Antoni's blessing. You know both those guys. They're both such affable guys. They feel like they can get along with anybody, and they usually do. They're usually right about that. So what happened in New York has been reported accurately. That is what happened in New York. But neither feels like, that's something they can't overcome or that it's an issue between them. They spent the Olympic time together since then. You know, they were, you know, the typical D'Antoni way when they met in Las Vegas, they put it out there directly. This is what we're expecting of you. This is how we would use you, as opposed to he'll come in and go, what do you mean I'm not starting if that's the case? Or what do you mean you want me to play four? Which was the case, not the starting part, but that was the case in New York where D'Antoni tries to run an offense that Carmelo doesn't want. You know, what do you mean I'm not posting up? We don't post up in my offense. That stuff's already out there, done, discussed, clear. Everybody knows what offense Mike D'Antoni runs now. So the things that they couldn't overcome, they couldn't get past in New York, they're already past here. Everybody knows what offense they run. They're going to run it. They're not going to, he's not going to say, you mean you're not posting me up every time down the floor? Yeah, this is news to you? So I just don't see it as a problem, partly because of their personalities and how they view their own personality of, I can get along with anybody. And so, it's absolutely true what happened there, but it's not really relevant to here.
Yeah, you're right. It was very much a forced marriage in New York with how that trade went down with Denver and the way, as you said, the way the Knicks played, especially when Jeremy Lin started to take off. And different situation, Houston. They're very much a pick and roll isolation kind of team right now under D'Antoni, which is a separate conversation of how they, how Mike evolved into that type of coach. But I mean, I just wonder, John, is Carmelo if asked to be a sixth man playing minutes in the end of the first, into the third, early fourth quarter for an entire season, is Carmelo Anthony really going to be, okay with that? He was a good soldier in Oklahoma City, but I just wonder how that role kind of fits him. Because that'll be the first time in his career that he'd be kind of actively choosing that type of role.
Right. He's never come off the bench, but I don't think that's the issue. I think it's more when he doesn't finish games.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be times that Capella, Tucker, Gordon, Paul, and Harden are the five on the floor. And that won't even be like a shocking, oh my gosh, what do you mean he's not on the floor? Well, those five guys finish games. Now, there'll be times they finish games as they did last year with Tucker as a center and Carmelo as a four. That could work, and they can do that in some matchups in some games. But there absolutely will be games that are good, tight, tough, close games and Carmelo comes out with 4 minutes left. How is he going to react to that, especially if it happens repeatedly? You know, if it happens once or twice, Eric Gordon didn't love the games he didn't finish, but, you know, they win. They won 65 last year. If they're not winning that number, and it happens quite a bit, that's the one that we need to see. I don't think the starting thing, that's already covered. That's one of the first things they said in Las Vegas. You know, you might not be here to start. Mike Vuzio is a four. P.J. Tucker's the four. There's a very good chance you're not starting. Now, yeah, you can still beat out James Ennis and start at the three. There's a good chance you won't, that you're a four and you be the backup. It's the finishing games that's what jumps out to me as the thing to watch.
Yeah, and John, I think that's going to happen a lot this year. I mean, if you watch the Thunder games last year, the Oklahoma City kind of came around to that, you know, especially towards the end of the season when Jeremy Grant was out there on the floor playing that kind of Carmelo role. If you've got, the way I see it, if you've got two guys in Harden and Paul, they're going to be the ball dominant players offensively. You want to put your best defensive lineup at every other spot out there on the floor. And that's never going to be, it's never really going to include Carmelo Anthony. I think you're going to see the majority of games, Carmelo Anthony sitting in the fourth and the end of the fourth quarter.
Maybe the majority of the real close ones.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of games where, hey, it's an 8-point lead. It's a 12, 14 point lead, whatever. But if it's an 8-point lead and you're rolling offensively as they hope to be able to do, and you know, there'll be some days PJ Tucker doesn't finish either. Even though clearly a better defensive player, they do think Carmelo as a four, he won't be as exposed as much. Plus they're switching style to some degree. Everybody kind of feels like, well, that can't work with him. And there are matchups and there are opponents that can't work. There's other times, for example, Carmelo's at a four. His guy sets a screen for James Harden. They switch. Well, James Harden spends a lot of games on the guy who's not going to go one-on-one. You're playing Oklahoma City, and he's on Robertson. They don't clear out, and Russell Westbrook makes sure Robertson goes one-on-one on Carmelo. That's not happening. And so, and then James is one of the areas that doesn't get talked about, but he's actually very good low-post defender. His numbers last year were remarkable as a low-post defender in those switches. The issue becomes when, okay, Chris Paul's guy, or Carmelo's guy screens for Chris Paul, and now everything, you can't just switch that because now Russell Westbrook can go one-on-one, or the guy who sets the screen can post up Chris Paul. That's where you start to get breakdowns. But there's a lot of situations. It's not as bad as people think. The other real good example, the Rockets game against Oklahoma City, the final meeting last year, the Rockets absolutely torched Carmelo in the first few meetings. They did all that switch stuff. They went one-on-one, and Chris Paul and Harden burned them pretty bad one-on-one, very bad, kind of like Donovan Mitchell in the playoffs.
Yeah.
The last time they met, Oklahoma City didn't switch like that. They were not going to expose Carmelo like that. He had a big first half, and Oklahoma City gets a good 12-point win or something like that win. And so it can be done, and it can even be done within the Rockets switching style to some degree.
Yeah.
It still has to work out. How do they make it work with Capella, Carmelo, PJ Tucker as your front court options?
Yeah, and where he can be an asset is offensively. I mean, how do you see D'Antoni using him? I mean, Mike's been great at kind of reinventing himself over the years. He now has, you know, a four-man that can, you know, do things offensively that previous four-men probably couldn't do in Houston. How do you think he works on that end of the floor?
Well, I think they do a lot of – they'll have him set screens for either Chris – probably Chris Paul's guy more because I think he'll be on the floor with Chris – Chris Paul's basically the Rockets' backup point guard. And so I think they're on the floor the majority of the time. There won't be a lot of time they're not on the floor together that one is. So you can have him set the screen for Chris Paul. If you don't switch, Paul just is such a master and has been for so long. That's where Clint Capella gets rich, is if you don't switch. And there's just so much that Chris Paul can do. If you switch, that's where I would think Carmelo gets his chance to be Carmelo, who he used to be Now, okay, you switched. You got the point guard on Carmelo. He's posting at the elbow. Go to work. And D'Antoni's absolute willingness to just have everything go one-on-one, that's where Carmelo can still be who he was. The other thing is he shot a real high percentage on open and wide open threes last year. You don't get anywhere near as many of those, really anywhere, as you do in this offense when you play with Harden and Paul. And so I think he's going to get a lot of those. Just the catch and shoot threes that is a part of his game, even though it wasn't a part of what made him one of the top scorers back in his best days. That's part of his game. He'll get a lot of those too. You just, for whatever reason, Chris Paul likes running to the corners, so that works out. One of the things that would not be good about Carmelo here is if he has to be the first guy to the corner. It's not him. It can, and you think, well, you're going to have to do that because that's what Trevor Ariza did. But PJ Tucker does it. Chris Paul, for whatever reason, is one of the surprises of last year that didn't get talked about. He loved working out of the corners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of Harden brings it up. So that can work where he can be out there on the wing. He can set the high screen that Ryan Anderson set his first year here. He can get plenty of touches that way, even playing with Harden and Paul.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subplot to the entire one of the most fascinating subplots in the league this year is Carmelo, because if he plays well in Houston as a sixth man who gets spot duty in the fourth quarter, he could extend his career by a few years, you know, doing that. If he doesn't, if he's stubborn and it sort of becomes a pain in the ass, he might have a hard time, John, finding a job next season if it goes that route.
Yeah, who knows? The Rockets have no bird rights on him, so how, if this is more than a one-year endeavor, he'd have to choose, okay, yeah, I'm going to play for minimums from now on, or portions of mid-level, taxpayer mid-levels, you know, or in this case, veteran minimum as a plus 10-year veteran. He can't look at here as a long-term thing unless that's what he wants to do. It is an interesting, that makes another layer of why it's such an interesting subplot to their season. And it's going to get so much attention, too, where there's other issues that you have to see how they develop. And as I say, Ennis is extremely important. He's got a more important role with a better team than he's ever been on. He's never had this expectation of him and need, but on the other hand, he only will be asked to do things he can do. Nobody needs him to go one-on-one or create shots for others or do any of that stuff. But he sure is important. You know, he's a big part of if they can be the kind of challenger to the Warriors that they were last year.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the front office. We know that Daryl Morey's never happy unless he's, you know, trying to find ways to upgrade his roster. How much flexibility do the Rockets have during the season to make moves? I mean, what's their – I mean, we know he's always willing to deal Ryan Anderson, that's for sure, but there hasn't been much interest in the last – couple of years. What kind of flexibility do you think Houston has to upgrade during the season?
Well, you know, he's never had, until this year, last season, he had never had a trade deadline in which he did not agree to a deal. And I have to word it that way because the one year he made a deal, he traded Motiejunas to Detroit and then Motiejunas failed the physical and they sent him back. So technically he did not make a deal that year. But last year was the first time as general manager he didn't agree to a deal. So there's a pretty good chance. I'm still betting on he'll do it again. They do have a chunk of their mid-level. It's a taxpayer mid-level, but they have a chunk of it left. And so in free agency, that post-trade deadline free agency, they can be active there as well. The real thing, you wonder, okay, Ryan Anderson now has 2 years left on that deal. That's tough to move, especially because everybody knows they have no place for him. So they have no leverage. You know, people could say, all right, you just keep him around and pay him $21 million next year and then get back to us when you get tired of that. And then we'll make you an offer. But when he's at the end of that, and he'll still have one more year after this. But now it's not as much. By February, you wonder if he's more movable. The only difference is most of those deals are somebody – you know, people look for somebody to put them over the top or they look to clear money. Well, he doesn't work as either of those. He's certainly not helping somebody clear money because of what comes in. Does he put somebody over the top, and do the Rockets help somebody do that, and do they get somebody that would help them that way off of a really good team? It's a tough one to do, but obviously Ryan Anderson with Carmelo coming in is very much the odd man out and the guy you have to watch. You know, that's the one when you talk about potential moves. Obviously, that's the one to watch most of all.
Let me ask you this. What did you make of the report that the Sixers are trying to pry Daryl Morey loose from Houston?
Yeah, it was more they were doing their initial work to get lists of potential candidates to work on. They didn't interview him. They didn't ask to come in for an interview. They were looking. It was the step before that that you do when you try to put together the here's who we can go chase work. And he didn't want a part of it. He was happier here, which is a real commentary on his ability to do the job the way he wants to do it with a new owner. You know, they sort of established this is how you do your job with the previous owner, but a new guy comes in, you have to do it to know whether he's really going to give you the resources and the support and the freedom to do it the way he had been. His saying, no, don't even go there, was more of a statement about that, about how it works with Tillman Fertitta, than it was about the Sixers or Daryl Morey.
Never boring down in Houston. Should be a really interesting season for the Rockets. John, I know you try to get your rest before we get into the throes of the season, man. Thanks for taking some time to join me here on the podcast.
Well, I enjoyed it. Yeah, it's going to be – they are an interesting team, aren't they? No matter what happens, they really are – there's always stuff with them.
I know you're more optimistic than I am that Carmelo and Mike D'Antoni are going to say kumbaya. Maybe it was my proximity to it, John, in New York, but that was as close to toxic as you could get. I just wonder how they.
It really was. I don't dispute that at all.
Yeah.
That it really was why D'Antoni left. I just think everything is different.
Sure.
Like you said, that was a forced marriage. Mm. You know, that really was. They traded, and it was a trade D'Antoni didn't want when they had to give up as much as they gave up.
Oh, yeah.
Carmelo had to know that, too. This is different. When you choose to go down that road, I just think it's very different. Plus, the Chris Paul, James Harden factor of it is very different when Carmelo was the man. And for 4 weeks, someone else was celebrated, and the offense is changing to ways he didn't like. It's just, I think it's a very different situation in so many ways. But something you know we'll be watching.
Yeah, no question. John, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Take care.
All right, joining me now on the podcast, Michael Grange covers the Raptors for Sportsnet up in Toronto. What's up, Mike?
Not much, Chris. I'm just enjoying a last little respite before things start going crazy. And reality is things are already starting to go crazy. We've got the Canadian women's team ramping up. We got Steve Nash going to the Hall of Fame next week. So we got the Canadian national team playing the week after that. So it's a busy time for Canadian basketball.
That's right. Steve Nash, Canada's favorite son, right? Going to the Hall of Fame early September.
Exactly. Big moment.
Big month for Steve Nash. Big year for Toronto. I mean, the Raptors, Mike, they've always been pretty good, at least the last like 5-6 years. This is probably the most interesting Raptors team that I've seen in a while. What do you think?
I totally agree. And, you know, before you get too deep into all the nuances of all the possibilities, you know, the one thing that's irrefutable, that's already proven, that is a fact, is the minute that trade went down, this Raptors team, season, organization went from, yeah, you know, interesting, good, a factor in the East, you know, but really maybe verging on the most boring story in basketball just because we knew the story so well, to being, you know, one of the top two or three storylines in the whole NBA, and just sent a charge, I think, through the league, but certainly in this marketplace. And it's been fascinating for me just being out and about, and either people kind of, you know, recognize me and, you know, I know exactly what the second question is going to be. And, or once, as soon as people realize that I do have some kind of role around the team, I know exactly I've had the same conversation 100 times, but with a huge swath of people, well beyond the, you know, your standard basketball fans. And that's what the Kawhi Leonard, DeMar DeRozan deal has done and for this team.
Yeah, certainly injected a lot of excitement into that team, and deservedly so. I mean, Kawhi Leonard at his best is an elite player. But let me ask you before we get into Kawhi, if he's not available over the summer, do you think this team returned intact?
Yes, I do. Not for lack of effort. You know, I know for a fact that there was considerable energy devoted to trying to make a pretty heavy-duty trade around the draft. There was different directions that were being considered. You know, there was an appetite, I guess you might say, or certainly an openness to reshaping this roster. And, you know, once you fire Dwayne Casey, you know, as accomplished as he has been with this franchise, kind of all bets are off. But I'm not convinced, you know, that Kawhi Leonard being available is sort of a perfect storm when you run it backwards. Like, you know, it is kind of remarkable that all these dominoes lined up. But, you know, I'm not convinced that they would have been able to make a worthy trade if Kawhi Leonard wasn't available. And it just would have bordered on kind of reckless to break up, which, you know, I'm convinced would have been a very good team again next year, you know, regardless of that move. So I would say if not for Kawhi Leonard being available, I think a highest probability was this team returning intact.
You know, the deal itself, look, I agreed with it. I mean, you have a chance to go acquire Kawhi Leonard when you're a team that's kind of stagnated. You go and do it. But there is an argument to be made that, you know, LeBron is out of the conference, you know, against Boston. And I know Boston is going to look different this year because of the guys they get back. But in Toronto, the two games they played there, I was at one of them, they ran Boston over. I mean, it was like a 19-point-per-game point differential in favor of the Raptors. You think that played in at all to them? Like that, you think there's any thought that, well, you know, LeBron's gone. You know, we're the best team in the conference without a deal. Or do you think they believe Boston is going to be that much bigger a threat to them down the line?
Well, I think there's a little bit to that. I mean, you know, Boston and Philly to an extent are obviously coming on. But, you know, I think that they just deeply believe they needed to do something different. They needed to change their mix. And, you know, so I don't think that move was done, you know, in response to anything. I think it was just more an internally motivated decision that went along. But to your point, you know, the risk factor of making that move, and there's all kinds of risks that have been taken on with this move, is higher because, you know, because of what you just described. The East is wide open. I think as constituted, the Raptors were well positioned to be, you know, one of the top three or four seeds in the East, no question. And, you know, so they didn't need to do anything to stay in that mix, but I think they felt compelled to do something because their goals are bigger and they wanted to try and reach them.
With the understanding, Mike, that, you know, at this point in the offseason, after a deal like this, everyone's saying the right things publicly. But what do you hear about just, you know, kind of how things are working between Kawhi, the coaching staff, the front office, his happiness level at showing up to camp in a few weeks as a Raptor? What are you hearing about all that?
You know, it has been very, very quiet, and I don't think that's any big surprise given, mm-hmm. you know, given who we're dealing with. The one window that, you know, has been opened into that was at the USA basketball camp in Las Vegas. Nick Nurse, the Raptors incoming rookie head coach, you know, did speak to a couple of reporters, local reporters, and, you know, said he had like a 45-minute sit down with Kawhi Leonard, you know, very early in the process. And they just talked basketball and they talked about sets and, you know, ran through different scenarios and how he would be used. And Kawhi was full of questions, and it was a really positive interaction, almost spontaneous is the way it was described to me, because Kawhi was just in for his physical, and you know, and basically the story gets told is you know, Bobby Webster and Masai Ujiri are like knocking on the door saying, look, we got to get going. And Kawhi and Nick Nurse, you know, wanted to keep talking nuts and bolts. So that seems very positive. But far beyond that, you know, it's been really quiet, and I'm sure that's how Kawhi Leonard wants it. But, I think there is some enthusiasm and some reports that he's training hard, competing hard. He's like no restrictions on his play, in off-season workouts, which is big. And so I think those are the two little slivers of daylight we have. And, you know, no surprise, they're both positive at this point.
You know, you mentioned Nick Nurse, and look, I know Nick a little bit. And when I wrote a piece last year about the top assistant coaches who are head coaching candidates, Nick Nurse kind of ran away with it from the perspective of executives. They ranked him number one of future head coaching candidates in the league. He's been a head coach and at other levels and been around the block certainly a few times internationally. But, you know, you're around this guy, you know, for the last few years. I mean, how would you describe who he is, his relationships with players, what his coaching style is going to be? What can you tell us about Nick Nurse?
Well, I think he's really prides himself on being willing and determined almost to think outside of the box. Now, what does that actually translate to? I mean, we've yet to find out. But you do get, because he came up so unconventionally, you know, small town kid from Iowa, you know, Division One basketball career, played a tiny bit of pro in England, you know, was going to be an accountant, almost stumbles into coaching and has to do it kind of the long way around. He's very I don't mean this in, you know, disparagingly, like he's not like arrogant about it, but he's not, I guess, overly impressed or maybe beholden is a better word to the belief that everything that's being done now is being done for the right reasons and being done the right way. And it's almost like a Mike D'Antoni feel in a way. Now that's obviously, you know, pretty high praise to, you know, company to put a coach who's never coached an NBA game as head coach. But that same way that there's that little bit of a reverence that Mike D'Antoni, you know, is, we've all kind of come to see as a bit of a trademark of his. I think Nick Nurse has a bit of that. And I think it comes from the idea that, you know, he's kind of had to do it a different way, and his ways have worked. And certainly there's a big influence from the Houston Rockets organization, where he was a G League coach, and just this willingness to try different things and, you know, understanding that it's kind of, it's not always about managing your quarter by quarter. I'm talking game, you know, quarter by quarter game results. It's about, you know, trying to build something within a season and over a number of seasons to maybe play basketball a little differently, a little more efficiently, whatever it might be. So smart guy, creative guy, easy to talk to. I think players like him. I think people like him. And, you know, and then the significant mystery here is what's going to happen when things go south, as they always do during an NBA season. And, you know, this is the first time you've got to deal with it. And you know, there's no way of knowing until it happens. But I think there's a good reason, as you point out, he was a really highly regarded assistant and head coaching candidate. And it's for a lot of those reasons I described.
Did it surprise you that the Raptors stayed internal with this? Because there were some interesting names on the coaching market, some guys that have been head coaches before that were available. Did it surprise you that they stayed in-house with Nick Nurse?
A little bit. No comment on Nick at all. More just that this was, this is a really good team. And whether they had made a move or not, they were going to be a really good team. And now, you know, you'd like to think that if Kawhi Leonard's, you know, healthy and committed, there may be a better team. And that's a lot to hand, you know, first year head coach. And, it just introduces a new layer of variables that, you know, Masai Ujiri is accountable for. And so from that basis, I think, you know, I know in early in the process, I think they were sort of leaning towards trying to get an experienced head coach. You know, Mike Budenholzer was, for a good reason, was maybe the leading candidate. Mm-hmm. But their version of events might be that you know, they kind of cooled on that opportunity. Maybe that's the case of Budenholzer cooling on them. I don't know. But I think once they kind of surveyed the field, they became more comfortable with Nick Nurse as the head coach. And again, it's in the same category of Masai Ujiri sort of really, I don't want to say rolling the dice, but really taking on some risk to see if you can squeeze a little bit more juice out of this particular stage in the organization.
So let me ask you this. You know, winning is clearly going to be the most important factor, I would think, in the Raptors' ability to retain Kawhi Leonard long-term. But outside of wins and losses and how far they get into the postseason, when you look at the relationships with the roster, the coach, the front office, what's the most important relationship to Kawhi Leonard in terms of keeping him around? What has to be the strongest?
That's a great question. I'm leaning towards saying, you know, Nick Nurse. You know, I think if you don't believe in the guy who's kind of running your team day in, day out, then, you know, that's going to be a problem. But I guess coaches are disposable. But, I think in terms of a guy like Kawhi Leonard just earning his respect and gaining credibility in his mind really quickly, I think Nick Nurse is going to be a big, big factor in that. And, you know, the rest of it, though, I think Toronto is kind of well-positioned. And you know, I know you've been up here a fair bit, Chris, so you get the vibe. But, you know, it's a substantive organization, right? Like it's the building is a good building. It's downtown. It's really got a great buzz and a feel, you know, that's on par with any of the buildings in the league. The practice facility is absolutely first class. It's convenient. You know, it's easy to access. You know, there's a high emphasis on being a good organization, treating players well, all these kinds of things. So I think, and then the city itself, I think, does sell to certain types of players. And there's a very strong history of players once they get here, really going, wow, this is actually a pretty cool place to live and work. So I think there's a lot of things lined up for it in favor. But, you know, I think the first stage is he's got to convince that there's a real future for him basketball wise to reach his goals and do it in such a way that would maybe make him choose here versus, you know, all the other choices I'm presuming he'll have as a free agent.
Yeah, I was always amused, Mike, by the narrative that, you know, the fact that it's cold up there 3 months out of the NBA season, like that's like this, that is the number one factor in Kawhi Leonard's decision-making tree. Like that never made any sense to me. I don't know what Kawhi Leonard thinks about the cold, if he's, you know, allergic to it, but I don't see that, you know, driving him out of Toronto or being the top reason he would leave if he does.
They don't spend a ton of time outdoors, Chris.
Yeah, it's not football. You know, Jesus.
It's you know, condo tower, underground parking, warm car, underground parking, practice facility. Yeah. So you know, they somehow survive.
I'm curious, Mike, to see how Masai Ujiri handles this season because, you know, I'm wondering if there are going to be ways that he empowers Kawhi Leonard. If he obviously wants to make him the face of the franchise and have him be their cornerstone player for years to come. Do you think he's going to do things to kind of make him, you know, feel like he has, you know, sort of quasi ownership in this team?
Yeah, I think he will. And he already has, right? Like he hired his
Jeremy.
The name right now because I'm
Jeremy Castleberry. Jeremy Castleberry. Yeah,
I appreciate that. But you know, they reached out and hired him, and he's obviously very, very close to Kawhi Leonard, both personally and professionally. And I think, you know, for good reason they hired him. I mean, they did have a need at the player development level here, with some of the staff going with Dwayne Casey to Detroit, and. You know, Kawhi Leonard's a pretty good advertisement. If he's your star pupil in terms of player development, you did a good job, right? Like he went from being a guy with a lot of potential, but a lot of gaps in his game to what we see or what we have seen in the last couple of years of his career. So that's an example, right? You go and get the guy who's he maybe trusts most with his game, and you bring him in house and do it, no questions asked. I think that's, you know, that's a pretty strong gesture. you know, he's absolutely going to get, you know, all the opportunities within the offense and defense to showcase his game as best he can. So, it'll just be a little bit interesting, and this will be part of the dance, I think, is from the perspective of Kawhi Leonard, you know, you want to give him all this stuff, like you want to hand over the keys, but like how willing will he be to taking that on outside of a basketball context, given, you know, in his mind, maybe he is just a visitor, I guess is what you would say. And how awkward can it be? I mean, I don't think you can't force it. You don't want to be saying, Kawhi, like, we want to put you on posters all over the city. And Kawhi's going, well, you know, that's great, but it'll make me look bad when I leave, you know? So I think it'll have to be a little bit more organic. And just, I think that's their only choice. I don't think from everything we know about Kawhi, and you're one of the few guys who's actually written a feature on the guy, Chris. I remember at Sports Illustrated. When you did that, about a 3-minute interview? Is that, oh, that's God, what I recall?
Yeah. I get chills thinking of the difficult. I will say this though, Mike. As you kind of enter that the Kawhi Leonard year in Toronto, or maybe more, as useless as Kawhi is when it comes to information about himself, his orbit, which includes Jeremy, by the way, and Uncle Dennis, who's taken a pretty good beating lately for some stuff, but is a tremendous anecdotal source. His guys are really useful. His people around him are really good.
Yeah, that's positive. But, as you know, having dealt with him firsthand, and I just don't think you can. The guy's not phony. Like, he's not about blitz, and it's not about, you know, look, we want to have you front and center at the film festival. Maybe they've offered all those things to him. But I think the relationship, it's going to have to be sincere. It's going to have to be organic. It's going to have to develop relatively quickly, but yet over time. Like, you know, and that's the best you can do, is I think as an organization, just put your best foot forward. I think there's this organization in the city has nothing to be, you know, embarrassed or ashamed or try to hide. I mean, it's a great place to live, work, play basketball. Mm-hmm. And you can only hope that Kawhi Leonard recognizes it, and the fact that they can offer him a whole bunch more money and more term than anyone else, tips the balance. But if not, I don't think the only way this thing really blows up is if for whatever reason Kawhi Leonard just can't play. Like, he's just, you know, whatever the injuries were that held him out so much last year are truly chronic. And he's just not able to play. And then you've kind of taken this huge swing, this huge miss. You've traded an icon and an Iron Man for a guy for damaged goods. And getting the outcome short of that is kind of understandable and probably worth the effort.
I would think that the performance of Kyle Lowry is going to be important in that too. I mean, you know, one of the reasons people like to compare the Paul George situation. And Paul George, a big reason he stayed in Oklahoma City is because Russell Westbrook was there. He liked playing alongside Russell Westbrook. I mean, Kyle Lowry's not Westbrook, but he's an all-star level guy, but did drop off last year in virtually every statistical category. I mean, what is, at 32 years old, what is Kyle Lowry? Do you think he can get back to that, you know, 2015-2017 type of level? Or is last year kind of indicative of what his ceiling is going to be?
Well, I think you got to be a little careful looking at some of that profile there, Chris, because there was an intentional decision made going right back to this time last year when they signed Kyle Lowry to a 3-year, $90 million, $100 million deal, which was above market. To part of the thinking there was they were going to pay you a premium to play a little less, have a little smaller role, keep you fresher. So on, you know, first glance, his numbers, there is a bit of a drop off, but I think on a per minute and ratios and those kinds of things, they're actually pretty strong. So I think that's all done to make sure that now going to year two and then next year three of that deal, that you can have him freshest and most able, as most as you can. And during the playoffs, like, as much as the Raptors struggled, Kyle Lowry did have a decent playoff, certainly offensively. And so I think there's still some optimism that he's going to be a significant factor. And, you know, I think Kyle Lowry is a great guy to play with, right? Like, I mean, he is tough. He is competitive. He's a smart player. He's a very good player. I think playing off a guy like Kawhi Leonard, there's going to be a great fit there. But to your point, I think, Lowry is going to, he really is the leader of that team, because the guy who might be the leader of the team, Kawhi Leonard, I don't know if he's got a strong track record as a leader. Mm-hmm. So, and so I think that's going to be a real interesting vibe to watch, is how, how Kyle wants to step into that role. And, one thing that people who aren't around the market might not get all the time is how much, how much DeMar DeRozan just sort of soaked up on behalf of Kyle in particular, just because he was such an easygoing guy. He did not place a lot of demands on a locker room or on a coaching staff or on a management team. And when Kyle didn't want to, Kyle was being kind of prickly and, the way he can be at times, that was fine, because, DeMar would cover up for him he could go on his way. That little security blanket's not there anymore. And I think there's going to be a lot more expected of Kyle, internally and externally, to be like a true leader and truly kind of, set a standard and set a tone. And that to me is a little bit more interesting to watch, or going to be interesting to watch, than how he plays on the floor. I think you're going to get a really good 32 minutes out of Kyle Lowry, just like you did last year, but it's some of the less measurable stuff that'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, that's interesting. The locker room dynamic that you described there. They get better with a healthy Kawhi Leonard, but this is also a team that should get better with some of these young guys too. I mean, they're not the sexiest of names out there, Mike, but guys like Ananobi, Van Vliet, even, Wright, go down the list. I mean, they've got some really good young players that especially part of that second unit last year, they should have, again, one of the most formidable second units in basketball.
100%. And, and when you were talking, we were talking earlier about what they can do to convince Kawhi Leonard this is a place to play. Well, that's a big reason. It's like, he's looking around, and I'm sure he doesn't have a ton of firsthand experience, especially having played not much last year and playing in the West, at what, Pascal Siakam is all about, or what DeLon Wright is all about, or Fred VanVleet and OG Anunoby and, that crew. But they are... There is there's some real players there. And I think, Ananobi, he had a good rookie year, particularly coming off an ACL in his senior year or his last year of college. But he had a great playoff, and, all the indications are he's had a great, off season, and he should be kind of more than a year removed from his ACL. So they're expecting big things from him. Pascal Siakam is a guy who, it's kind of ridiculous to breathe him in the same breath as Draymond Green, but the analogy is a kind of a guy who is a little bit out of position early in his career, grew some of his game to kind of find a position for himself, and the game kind of evolved to help him find a position, and just this kind of really a high IQ, high energy, a quality that allows him to be a perfect kind of wing / big in this type of basketball. And Siakam is a guy, he's shown signs of being a good 3-point shooter, like a very good 3-point shooter. But his ball handling, decision-making, passing, athleticism, motor, like they're already pretty elite for a big. And, these are the kind of guys, we saw what Fred VanVleet did as a sixth man of the year candidate as a rookie. And that's why there is so much enthusiasm and deservedly so for this group. As I think Kawhi Leonard perfectly complements the talent that's on hand and vice versa. This is not a case of, there's a reason the team won 59 games last year, and there's no reason they wouldn't be a better team than they were this time a year ago, at least on paper.
Let me finish with this, Mike. Obviously you do some things to maximize Kawhi Leonard, and maybe you tweak some things defensively. But Nick Nurse, coming from Dwayne Casey's staff, and obviously had a lot of input, to say the least, in what they did offensively last year. Do you expect any substantive changes in the style of play for Toronto this season?
Yeah, I think there will be. I think they might even go further down the road of the kind of space and pace route that they kind of went down last year. I think defensively, it's interesting. I mean, Nick gets, coaches get labeled, right? And so Nick's a defensive coach, an offensive coach, not a defensive coach. But,
right.
When you talk to him, he's got all kinds of ideas about what they can do differently defensively. And, and I think that is an important thing, because in the playoffs last year, it wasn't their offense that let them down. It was defense. They just could not figure out how to get stops consistently, certainly against LeBron James. But so I think you'll see differences. And, there needs to be differences. There should be differences. Why go to the trouble of firing a guy, like I say, a quality person, as we all know, Dwayne Casey, and certainly the track record that he built up here, if you want things to look the same? So exactly how it'll shake out, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But I having talked to Nick as an assistant, he certainly would come across as a guy who, was going to take his shot. I don't think he's going to get the head coaching job and all of a sudden start being careful. I think he's going to go and go, this is my chance. And, I'm not going to let it go by without, I'm going to get, if it doesn't work, it's going to be because I did it my way. I think that's obviously the only way you can do it as a head coach in this league.
Yeah, certainly should be interesting. They've been a good team, like we said at the top, for a long time. But, most compelling Raptors team we've seen in a very long time, probably since the days of Vince Carter. Mike, always appreciate the time, man. Good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll be seeing you up there in Toronto real soon.
All right, Chris. Thanks. Enjoy what's left of summer.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Jonathan Fagan and Michael Grange for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.